Welcome to our Holden Village podcast. For over 50 years now, Holden Village has traveled a rich history of faith that has transformed a copper mining town into a vibrant place of education, programming, and worship. Holden has sought to welcome all who seek contemplation and community in the remote wilderness of the beautiful Cascade Mountains. We continue to invite people of all ages to come alongside our rhythms, which inspire and equip travelers for a sustainable life of faith outside the village. And we continue to listen and reflect on our story and history and seek to discover our place in God's creative mission in our world. Our podcasts are a way of sharing our conversations with our teaching faculty around reformation, the reforming of our relationships with the earth, with each other, and with the divine. Let's tune in and join the conversation.
Hi, my name is Jason DeRose. I am leading a series of sessions at Holden called Unearned Intimacies on the Ethics of Telling Other People's Stories. And we're talking about journalism ethics because I am a journalist. I am an editor at National Public Radio, NPR News. I edit Western news, sort of from Colorado West. And I edit religion coverage and LGBT coverage and Native American coverage. So I have a lot of things that I oversee. One of the questions that I have throughout this week, throughout my presentations, is how do we tell other people's stories in ways that the people, the subjects of our stories, hear themselves represented accurately, with sensitivity, with genuineness, but also in ways that help people who aren't the subjects of the stories understand what's going on. So we're talking about how do we understand how we tell the stories about others, and how do we understand how we tell the stories about ourselves. The title that I mentioned a moment ago is Unearned Intimacy. And I think that this is something that happens a lot within journalism. I think the best way to understand what unearned intimacy is to understand what earned intimacy is. So I think of earned intimacy as you've been friends with someone from college for 25 years, you've got long experience together, you've had those heartrending conversations at 19, you've also had those heartrending conversations at 40 years old. That's an earned intimacy. Another kind of earned intimacy might be your relationship with your pastor, that you've been a member of this congregation for 10 years, that person baptized your kids, was there when your parent died. It's a kind of earned intimacy between the two of you. You also have earned intimacy between siblings, perhaps. You and your kids might have an earned intimacy. But there's some mutual give and take in earned intimacy. But unearned intimacy is this, unearned intimacy is the result of a journalistic encounter. So you are going about your day and say you're a chaplain at a nursing home and you work with people who have dementia and that's part of your job. And then this journalist comes in and wants to do a story about your work as a chaplain for people with dementia and wants to talk to the family members of the people who the chaplain is caring for. And if the chaplain and the families agree to that interview, you're engaging in this act of unearned intimacy. They can always say no. Like, an elected official probably can't say, no, I don't want to talk to you. Although these days it seems like some more and more elected officials are not interested in public transparency. But if you're a private person going about your private world and you're, just a journalist finds you interesting and you agree to that interview, agree to be the subject of a profile, you're engaging in this act of unearned intimacy. You're allowing that journalist into your life in a way that is peculiar and unusual. You wouldn't generally walk up to a stranger and say, by the way, my grandmother has dementia. You would only get to that point if you already had some kind of earned intimacy. But journalists enter people's lives often in a difficult moment in their lives. The plane has just crashed with your parent on it. You've just lost the election. I guess that's a more public... But, you know, some turmoil is in your life, and a journalist comes in and wants to talk to you. So I think that people, the subjects of those interviews, might confuse what's going on there, because it isn't a true intimacy. It's a sort of performed intimacy with the journalist, and it's not a two-way street. The journalist is not going to want to answer the same questions that she or he is asking the subject. And in some instances, a journalist might give up a little private information to get to make the other person comfortable. But more often than not, the journalist is going to, you know, play his cards very close to his vest, not disclose too much information, or just enough to get the person talking, but not say, oh, my grandmother too had dementia. Because then the journalist is sort of influencing how the person is talking to that, to him or her. And remember that this journalistic encounter of unearned intimacy isn't for the sake of either the reporter or the subject. It's for the sake of an audience that doesn't have special insight into the situation. And so you need to have a conversation. You need to ask the questions that will help others who don't know anything about this topic understand it, think about it, learn about it, be interested in it. So that's what I'm doing during my sessions. And
I've never heard the two put together, unearned and intimacy.
I think that that's very true, that the person who's telling the story gets some benefit out of telling the story, especially if it's not a story they've been telling over and over and over again, mm-hmm. but rather a new story in their lives. Mm-hmm. Maybe 15 years ago, when I was covering a lot of the clergy sex abuse stuff going on in the Catholic, but all the other churches as well, I remember interviewing a survivor of clergy sex abuse. And after I interviewed him, he actually had contact. He saw me at some event covering a protest, and he came up to me and said, "You know, I'm interested in talking to you about what happened to me." And so we set up a time later to chat when he could come to the studios. And I interviewed him for about an hour about his whole experience. And after it ended and I, you know, pressed save, he said to me, "You know, that's the first time I've ever talked about that to somebody who wasn't either my therapist or a very close family member. But I thought it was important now to talk publicly about what happened." And I have a great deal of respect for him for doing that. I also, and then I asked him, this was after, as I said, we stopped recording, how was it different talking to me versus other people, the very few other people he talked to? And he said, well, with therapists, there's sort of this goal that there will be some kind of processing and closure over the course of the months or years of therapy. And with the family, there was this idea that if I told them, they would, you know, view me differently and understand something about me. But he said, with you, it was much more sort of a blank slate of, I think it's just important to tell the story so that other people can hear the story, not for anything that I'm going to get out of it. Because sometimes the subjects of pieces of journalism end up having not such great consequences for being the subject of that. So I could imagine, I don't know this to be the case with the person I'm telling you about now, but, like, you know, I did do a story about him. I asked the Archdiocese for comment. They wouldn't comment about the case. But what if, say, somebody from a congregation heard his story and decided to harass him about spreading rumors about the church or, you know, speaking ill of a priest? And what if the congregation that he, I don't know, if he, I can't remember if he went to church still or not, but, like, what if that changed the nature of his relationship with his own congregation or with friends of his, because they didn't know that he was a survivor of abuse? There could be consequences to being the subject, and they're not all good. Mm-hmm. sometimes there is good consequence, like people respect and admire you and have compassion for what you've gone through, but people also become very upset because you've told the truth. You've told on someone. And so I think it does change the person telling the story, but it sometimes is harmful for them to tell the story. And as a journalist, I don't like to walk into an interview saying, like, are you sure you want to do this? Bad things could come of it, because nobody would talk to you if you did that. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. But I do think sort of more generally, there might be, you know, might need to be a need for better media education in the United States. But
In what way?
Well, if people, so that people who interact with journalists understand what that's about. Why mm-hmm. would you do it? Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people think, unfortunately, that like journalists do it to get rich and famous, which is funny because very like a handful of people on TV are rich and famous journalists. Most of us make decent but not great livings doing what we do, and very few people do it to get famous. Most of us do it because we have an interest in the truth, and we have an interest in telling the truth, in a belief that telling the truth shapes the culture for the better, mm-hmm. even if the truth is hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the honesty can be uncomfortable, but it's like I said, the processing thing that helps people move on from things, and then helps other people realize sort of just the spectrum of humanity that happens, and helping assure people that, you know, there's such a wide range, and we're quite similar, but things that aren't, yeah. And then...
Well, you mentioned the word trust, which is, I think, interesting, because there's sort of a lack of trust in media in general. I happen to work for a news organization that has a fairly high trust level.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, I didn't personally earn that trust. I helped the company earn that trust.
Yep.
But when I, so often I think people will talk to people in public radio because I've heard people say this when I ask them, I say, oh, well, I'll talk to you, you're the good guys. I don't necessarily want to think that I am the only good guy or that public media is the only good guy, but the trust that they're placing in the journalist has to do with the institution that they represent. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily, if I were going to be interviewed by some organization, I wouldn't necessarily let myself be interviewed by some news organizations versus others.
Yep.
Like, I might agree to, you know, Slate or The New Yorker, but I might not agree to, and that yeah. has more to do with like the reputations of the company and where I would want to show up as a subject.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is NPR's, with it being a sort of good guy seeming news organization, what is their mission? Because there's definitely more need now for like deeply honest mm-hmm. reporting, and then like newsrooms. I mean, I remember learning that newsrooms, like local ones, are becoming fewer, mm-hmm. And it's becoming more of a nationalized thing, and like the whole idea of many, many reporters in a newsroom. Just sorting through facts and not having just the overarching organization or mission dictate how it's going to be reported.
Well, I would say, I mean, I haven't memorized the NPR mission statement, but the I would say that it involves a couple of different pillars. It's to cover the news,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, we have 800 people in the news division thinking about what the news is every day, and we mm-hmm. have, you know, a diversity of people thinking about it so that it isn't just a small group of people who are very much alike thinking about what the news is. But one of the early mission statements used this phrase, you know, the mission of public radio is to inform, enlighten, and inspire. And I think that many news organizations might have the inform part, like mm-hmm. we cover the news. Mm-hmm. But enlighten and inspire are not the kinds of words you see in corporate mission statements very often. It's quite often maximizing audience that you make.
Of course, yeah.
At a not-for-profit like NPR, like public media, we are interested in serving a large audience. We are mm-hmm. interested in having the largest possible audience because we want people to have good information. Mm-hmm. That in turn does help us make more money, but we as a nonprofit put most of that money from a larger audience mm-hmm. through, say, membership support or underwriting into opening more offices to mm-hmm. we're about to open a bureau in the Philippines to cover sort of Southeast Asia. You know, we want to expand Latin American coverage. So we're always, I would say the reinvestment from the growth of audience that we're serving is to better serve an even bigger audience mm-hmm. all the time. So inform, enlighten, it isn't just enough to know what's happening, but to know why it was happening, mm-hmm. how it happened, what were the causes of the tragedy, what were the causes of, you know, this election or this medical breakthrough. And inspire, I would say, it's not inspire in some sort of woo-woo way. It's more like the news is very hard, especially these days. It seems like there's just a rat-a-tat-tat of difficult, hard news. And I think in a good deal of the coverage that I do that isn't just breaking news, I try to think about, what is the hopeful story we can tell here as well?
That's a good word.
What is the thing that is a moment of joy? Maybe mm-hmm. it's not a very important story, but there's just 3 minutes, the end of all things considered, as you're sitting in your driveway, that will just say, oh, there's some beauty in the world. There's some goodness in the world. Mm-hmm. So it's not inspire as in inspire them to do something, but inspire them to inspire the audience to sort of appreciate wonder and awe at the world. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I would describe that as our mission statement.
No, that's fantastic. And that holds, yeah, I mean, it makes sense you're at Holden.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because, having and sharing and sort of multiplying that hope is really important.
I think that it's important as journalists, as an agent within democracy, help people not feel completely out of control. I think that we're at a moment in history right now where people feel like the world is chaotic and that they are bandied about by all of these forces that they have no control over. And I think that some of those forces they don't have control over. But, you know, in a democracy, you have a lot of control over what happens. And so helping people understand that they are not, you know, the victim bystander of everything, but that they can engage in civil society and that they could help things change for the better. I mean, at the very early mission statement of NPR had this whole, remember, it was being written in like the 70s during like all sorts of peace movements and political movements. And there was this notion of progressivism as like, we don't have to be what we were, we could be better than we are. And I worry with sort of the national political rhetoric sometimes that we don't see the future as better than the past. We see the future as the past was best and we need to get back to the past in order to be good again. And I don't think that that's true. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm too Lutheran about this, but I'm not positive that there is like absolute trajectory of progress. But I also think that you have to live with the hope. You can't just sort of curse God and die. You have to live in hope and not yes. with resignation to whatever happens is just what the world gives me.
So what are some church, religion, Native American, and LGBT? What are some, I'm just curious, what are some upcoming stories or topic in any of those that you're interested in?
Sure. as a rule, I don't talk about what hasn't aired yet, but I can talk about what's recently aired.
Okay.
So we're recording this on the 4th of July. Yesterday, I had a big piece air on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, I believe, since I'm here, I don't know if it aired, but it was scheduled to air, on the history. It's the big anniversary of this document in the Catholic Church called Humana Vita, which was the ban on birth control, or a reaffirmation of the ban on birth control within the Catholic Church. And so we're looking at how this widely disliked piece of theology, 83% of Catholics use birth control, yet it is forbidden by their church. Mm-hmm. How, if you create a rule that people don't believe in and very few people follow, how does that affect their relationship to all the rules in the church? Is everything up for personal decision about whether to follow it or not? And a lot of people would argue that within the Catholic Church, that is exactly the situation, that if you create a rule that is unfollowable, then you will, if you can say that law is wrong, it creates a disregard for all law. Or it creates a disrespect for the institution as to not understand the lives of the people mm-hmm. that that they are serving. So that's a piece that aired recently. Oh, I will tell you about this piece. I have a piece coming up. It's scheduled to be on this coming weekend. It's not super newsy, but it's a nice little piece. It is about digital distraction and Buddhist practice. So, you know, we have these distraction devices that we all carry around that, you know, we sort of spend all day scrolling down Facebook or scrolling up Twitter. And as great as it is to not be able to do that here, most people who aren't here are doing that right now. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of Buddhist groups around the country that have started creating meditation practices that make people more mindful of their use of digital devices. So it's really great.
Important.
So the story is about this actual meditation class where you come to the meditation class and you meditate, but your phone is in front of you, but it's off. And then after 30 minutes of meditation, you turn it on and you start surfing the web, looking at Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And then after about 10 minutes of that, the leader asks people around the room to talk about their, like, what are they actually feeling now? Like, you just had this moment of serenity in your meditation, mm-hmm. and then you went right from that into the most attached, unserene, distracting thing possible. Mm-hmm. How do you, like, the juxtaposition of those two experiences should help you understand what this digital connection is doing to you, mm-hmm. unless mm-hmm. you control it rather than let it control you. And people went around the room and talked about it, like, their hearts started pounding, all of these dire consequences to it. So that's a piece that's coming up in a couple of days. If no major news breaks, then we don't have to.
It sounds like a good way to reprogram and be more, just more aware when you do pick it up. That it's weird how I think it's inevitably changing our brain and our communication patterns and kids with. Awesome. Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us for another Holden Village podcast. Be sure to view the links in the description for more information or visit our website to find out more about the village. We hope you will make a pilgrimage to Holden. Blessings and peace to you.